And welcome now to the midday for a Tuesday. I'm Norman Gilliland, and I have a guest with me today. Donna Storing's her name, and she's a pianist who has, still is traveling broadly. In fact, what came through the storm yesterday,
last night,
a time or two on your way back down to Chicago. Well, welcome to the midday, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for including me on this crazy whirlwind trip.
Yeah. So what about this crazy whirlwind trip?
We left by car, California, a week and a bit ago. And we've been stopping at universities and performance halls and radio stations along the way to meet with people that are interested in our global nonprofit and its mission and message, which is all about music.
Yes, it's about preserving musical cultures, I guess. Did I get that right?
That's a byproduct, and it's a very important one, of course. Absolutely. I founded Listen for Life 16 years ago with the suggestion of many of my mentors, including late Sir George Schulte, and Lady Schulte became one of our first donors, and which we were incredibly excited and grateful about, of course. But the whole idea was to, yes, preserve music cultures and genres as a way to create alternative media programming for radio and television on a number of networks worldwide so that the music listeners of today can have a wider range of inspiring, nourishing music at their disposal, if you like, rather than just what tends to be the mainstream, popular media.
There's always this kind of two-edged sword, though, isn't there, Donna? Because on the one hand, musical tastes are becoming so eclectic, so diverse, so
which
globalized. But on the other hand, how do you describe what it is you're marketing or promoting?
No, that's a very good point. We've always taken pains to say, Listen for Life, the whole idea behind it is to listen for the life that is in the music, whatever music you choose. So we go into schools, for example, with musicians, master musicians of many cultures who carry instruments that most of the students have never seen before in their lives. And we, get them playing and the kids get excited. And then we get across to them that the idea is all music, whether it has lyrics or not, delivers a message. And we empower them to make positive music listening choices and realize that they can turn off a message they don't like or that makes them feel negative or down or violent or whatever the case is. And we then help them to create their own positive music messages, their own songs, so that they learn that they too can say something through music. And hopefully that will impact the music that is created by the musicians of tomorrow. And that's our main goal, is to inspire musicians and music producers to realize the power and the responsibility that we all have with our gifts to make the world a more spiritually nourished place.
And there are a lot of gifted young musicians out there, whether they even know it or not.
Tremendous number right now.
Well, we're going to narrow that focus from a global approach down to a single nationality just for fun. And that's going to be Russia, which, of course, still is a hotbed of all kinds of great music, especially for the last 200 years. It's been a good couple hundred years for Russia.
Definitely.
And we'll focus, first of all, on this notorious piece. The composer got really tired of it, wrote it at the age of 20, and it became synonymous with Sergei Rachmaninoff, and he had to play it. A teacher that I had many years ago said he saw him play this in the 1930s as an encore, and then he just slammed it on the piano because he was so tired of this piece. But everybody else to this day still loves this prelude in C sharp minor.
Well, some people may not know, even though they'll, as soon as I start the piece, everybody goes, oh, they know this piece, even if they might not recognize the title, right? But what a lot of people don't know about it is why he wrote it in the first place and what message he was trying to portray at the time, even though he got sick of it later. And that is that when he was a child, he was always brought by his grandmother to the Russian, monasteries on Sunday mornings. And he always related how that was one of the most powerful influences on all of the music he ever created, walking across the square, which was surrounded by monasteries. And they would all start ringing their bells on Sunday morning at the same time. And so they started with the big, low, deep bass bells, and then the middle ones, and then the high ones. And they all echoed back and forth across the square. And he said it was this glorious cacophony of sound. And you never heard until the, except for when the big, low bass bells started. After that point, when they all started joining in, you never heard just one bell going. You heard the overtones, and you heard the ringing, and you heard all of the sound. So he tried to create a piece that would help us to know years later what it felt like to walk across that square, what it felt like to be Rachmaninoff or anyone else at that time walking across that square and hearing all of these bells ringing.
He later, of course, wrote this fantastic choral work, The Bells, based on Poe, which is very much in the same spirit. But here, he's got it all boiled down to about a four-minute piano piece.
Or less, yeah. And some contemporary pianists today, the students, you know, if they don't know that story, they try and play it very cleanly, you know, pedaling every single chord.
Instead of
overlapping. It's kind of dry instead of letting it all overlap. So
here it is, a prelude in C-sharp minor by Rachmaninoff. Has Rachmaninoff's fingerprints all over it, doesn't it? Couldn't be anybody else.
No.
The Prelude in C-sharp minor.
Wonderful, wonderful composer.
Was there an aha moment for you, Donna, when you must have played this as a very young pianist and perhaps for years before you heard what it was really all about?
Actually, no. The very first piece by Rachmaninoff I ever played was his Piano Concerto No. 1 in F-sharp minor.
Oh, that's a good one to start with. yes. We have a very young pianist who's going to be playing that on our show on July 16th.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. And recently did play it at a concert. Yes, on a concert on the square.
Oh, yeah. So, well, I was a teenager, and my piano teacher wanted me to enter this, you know, orchestra competition, concerto competition. And I wanted to play Rachmaninoff's Second, which I had heard on the radio. And he said, oh, everybody plays that one.
Yes, everybody loves that one.
Learn the first. And I started, you know, playing the melody. It's so beautiful. And I said, okay, I'll learn this one. And I had no idea that it was really hard. So, you know, the determination, I think, for all young people to you fall in love with a piece, and then it makes you learn it. And that's definitely the story for the second piece that we're going to share in this program. It was Rachmaninoff. He relayed the story that when he wrote it, that he felt it was one of the best pieces he ever wrote, but that he was sad because he felt no one would ever play it because it was, in his words, next to impossible to play. And I just opened the book somewhere and fell in love with the first phrase, and I had to play it. I had to learn. My hands barely reached an octave. So it was, for me, a real challenge, but it was definitely worth it.
And we're going to be going just past 12:30 with our to our quiz question with this, and it's the which movement of this sonata that we're going to hear?
Of the
first movement of this sonata. And so this sonata, you don't hear the sonatas of Rachmaninoff very often, do you? Is it because they're so difficult?
Well, there's a few reasons. He wrote this piece as a symphony for piano. And you do have to think like a conductor. And there are so many different lines going on at the same time. It's extremely contrapuntal. There's every instrument in the planet that's layered very thickly, and you have to try and ferret them all out with different, you know, tones on different fingers all at the same time so you can follow the lines. But the reason that he did that was he was in Dresden at the time, and he had had, for all intents and purposes, what we would call today a conversion experience. He had never been a particularly spiritual or religious person, as he put it. And when he got to Dresden, something happened, and he had a complete change of mind about this and felt very concerned for his friends back in Russia. And he wanted somehow to write a piece that would be a veiled message to them about his new thinking and what he hoped they would find. So he chose the story of Faust, which at that time, many, many, many composers were writing.
Oh, yes, very popular over the years.
Everything about Faust, right?
Yes.
The story. And instead of writing an opera or anything else, his, you know, favorite medium was a piano. And so he wrote the complete story of Faust on the piano in three movements. And each movement tells the whole story of Faust, but from the viewpoint of one of the three main characters.
Oh, sure. And so which character do we get for this first movement?
The first movement is from the viewpoint of Faust. You know, as an aging philosopher looking for the meaning of life.
And knowledge not available to most mortals.
Right. So each character, throughout all three movements, they have themes, they have idée fixes, and each melody, each theme in every one of the movements is followed, you can trace it through. So, for example, the theme of the second movement comes in the first movement because that's Greta.
Sure.
And then, you know, Mephistopheles and the Witch's Ride opens the third movement. But the first movement that we're going to hear now was him setting up the story. And basically, just to help your listeners, anything rising up from the base of the piano upwards is Mephistopheles coming up out of the netherworld to tempt him, to try and, you know, befriend him, okay? And anything coming down is grace, help, assistance from the spiritual side. And then the second movement the second theme is a Gregorian chant. And that comes in every time to sort of say, here's one way you could look. You could look over here. And the opening theme is Faust searching, and it's a question. And it has a question and an answer part. And so you can follow this all through the whole first movement, and it's setting up this huge battle between the rising lines and the descending chords and the Gregorian chant, and it all gets mixed in together with a very quiet finish because we're setting up the entrance of his life with Greta.
Yes, right. Yeah. So, okay, this is, in the meantime, the first movement is the struggle for the soul of Faust.
That's right.
Of this piano sonata by Rachmaninoff. And we'll be hearing this from a recent recording that you made. My guest today is Donna Stirring.
This was a live performance. So
cool.
Thank you.
the story of Faust, told by Sergei Rachmaninoff in the first movement of his piano sonata number 1 in
D minor,
as played by my guest today, Donna Storing. Well, we had best get to some more music here. I should mention that that recording that we just heard of Donna Storing, she made in concert in Houston of the Rachmaninoff now, and we're going to go from Rachmaninoff to Scriabin.
Scriabin Fantasy in B minor. This is a piece that's been special to me also for concerts for many years. And it was written just about the same time as the Rachmaninoff sonata that we just heard the first movement of, within a few years of each other. And another thing that the two composers had in common was, at least in the early periods of Scriabin, was the fascination with the interval of a second and then the ninth, you know, the reverse of it.
Sounding like so. What? There's your second.
Both of those, and then if you reverse that and it becomes a ninth, you have, which is the second upside down. Mm-hmm. So this fantasy in B minor starts and creates this one single melody throughout the entire piece, which is, again, a very common device for composers at that time. Liszt and several people did that, where you had one theme throughout the entire piece. And what he does with this theme, the many different personalities, moods he takes the listener through in this one theme, is just incredible. And that's why I think he calls it a fantasy. He's kind of dreaming about, what can I do with this?
Fantasy in
B minor
by Scriabin.
Thank you.
There you have A Fantasy by Alexander Scriabin, played by my guest today, Donna Storing. And now back to Donna Storing and more from the piano here in just a moment, though. Now, that Scriabin piece, is that something that you play often? Is it sort of a pet piece of yours, if that's the term to use?
Yes, it did become that. And I've been fortunate to get to share that piece on the major concert halls around the world. And one of my special memories of sharing that was on a tour of Russia that I was invited to do, playing solo concerts at the Philharmonic Hall in St. Petersburg, which is a very rare treat, apparently, and I really, really enjoyed it. Their audiences are so amazing. And it was great to get to bring Russian music to them as well. And I was invited back every year, so I've now had several wonderful experiences there throughout the country. But when I was first there, I was unaware of something that they do for guests as a gift. If they like a performer, they want to share their music and their performers with you after your concert. And so I was greeted at the stage door by an entire balalaika band.
What fun.
I mean, it maybe 30 pieces, 40, and all different sizes of balalaikas.
Right, yes.
It was wonderful. And they were playing all these things for me, and they asked me, well, what would you like us to play for you? Well, I didn't know very much balalaika repertoire, so I was trying to think of something that I had heard. And I said, I know that on the movie Dr. Zhivago, the Laura's theme is played by balalaikas. So
right, because by
play
a French composer. Maurice Jarre, a great composer.
Well, yeah.
Did Lawrence of Arabia.
So they said, the what? And they had no idea what I was talking about.
Really?
So I said, you know, the theme. And they said, no, they didn't know.
No
so
kidding.
I sang it, you know, I hummed it for them. And they said, oh, that. Oh, we know that. And I said, well, what do you know it as? And they said, that theme, that melody is a very ancient folk tune that we learn in kindergarten. And so apparently that song had been based on an actual Russian folk tune, which
and
is really
so neat. You have a kind of a riff
so
on that.
So I then created a encore for them, which I've played ever since anywhere, that turns the Laura's theme into a balalaika on the piano, hopefully.
Okay, here we go. Thank you. Well, you can hear the balalaikas, sure enough.
Oh, thank you.
Laura's theme. It was kind of an international project, wasn't it? You had Omar Sharif, an Egyptian guy, playing this, you know, Russian Dr. Zhivago. Yeah. And you had the thing, much of it, shot in Spain. You know, there was like 100 degrees
I've
out or something.
I heard so many different stories about where that was filmed. Yes.
Yeah, it's a kind of a fascinating cinematic collaboration. So why not have a French composer, you know, using this Russian theme for the Dr. Zhivago music? His early work was very convincing.
Well, you know, at the time, they were not allowed to read the book or see the movie.
Right.
And so it made total sense to me when I thought about it later, because this was before Perestroika, the first time I got to go over there.
Oh, yes, of course then.
Yeah, if you say the theme music to the film Dr. Zhivago, they're like, what?
Yeah, something that didn't get into the Soviet Union because, of course, you didn't have the internet.
At that time,
you didn't even have really, you didn't have DVDs, let alone, or VCRs or any of that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so the local people playing the balalaikas, you know, the intelligentsia would have known, but, you know, the general people wouldn't have known. So fascinating to share all these cultures and travel around and get to do that. I'm very blessed.
So how much time do you spend in any one place?
Well, what I'm wanting to do right now is get back to the artist coaching and the teaching that I've done for so much of my life, primarily in Europe, across all the music conservatories in Europe. And I'd like to now be able to do that for residencies here in the U.S., whether it's 3 days or 3 weeks or 3 months or 3 years, you know, and be able to really impact, hopefully, the performers, not just the pianists, but the music majors throughout the country, because I feel we have such a great and important opportunity right now as musicians. So helping musicians to perform, to find muscular ways to relax and get a deeper tone or just share their phrasing, whatever their instrument or their voice, is something that I want to do. So I'm traveling a little less than previously have been in recent years.
Are you still doing some concertizing?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Playing with orchestras?
And yeah, I'm very, very fortunate to get to have sort of a quadruple life as a full-time, you know, concert artist and teacher, you know, traveling to do guest artist residencies in as many places as I can. And also creating television programs for networks around the globe, as well as for our own channels through Listen for Life.
Wow.
About music, and just getting to be involved with UN agencies in Geneva on the use of music to address conflict resolution and
Great.
Other important projects.
Well, so, thanks for stopping by and participating in our little project called The Midday today.
Oh, very much appreciate
it. Coming all the way up from Chicago for that. And really appreciate that weather again. My guest today has been Donna Storing.
Thank you so much.